I'm very happy to be here, and I'm grateful to the organizer for making this possible. So what I'm going, do you hear me?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
That just for recording.
Yeah, all right. No, I was talking to that guy at the end of this slide. So, probably this, it's nonlinear elasticity as a function of scale in the planar limit. So this is a problem that has preoccupied me for a long time. So the original idea for this thing was that if you combine perturbation theory and something that is called effective ring theory with a characterization of the crossover between the regimes of validity of perturbation theory and effective string theory, it might be possible to get the number sigma n over lambda n squared, where sigma n is the string tension, and lambda n is the perturbative scale. So this is the pure number that, sort of the most basic pure number about QCD, at least for n very large relative to 1, to reasonable accuracy and by analytical means. So that was the idea. And things like this was tried in the early days of latitude theory. But the crossover was and remains poorly understood and also uninteresting in some way because it has lots of lattice artifacts. In itself, the new ingredient as an input that I added is that n is very large, and this should make the effective string theory approach more plausible. Because when n is very large, you expect that you don't need to know the entire effective string theory. You just need this one very special two-dimensional sigma model, which would give you what you want. And that one has a much better chance of being really well defined. In itself, effective string theory makes continuum universal predictions. So what I meant by so this is in continuum, and it makes, it has a subset of predictions which are universal. In both those respects, it's much better than the strong coupling expansion of lattice gauge theory. And this sounds quite flaky. So you need a real concrete guess. So the original guess was that when n is very large, this crossover would itself also have universal aspects. Okay? So the way I'm going to present my talk is sort of like a story. I shall start with a simple lattice result and just follow it. Let us try to understand it and see where it leads us. And what it would lead us is to a new qualitative non-perturbative fact about the crossover in four-dimensional pure Young-Mills SU engaged theory for n much larger than 1. So the logic here is simply to use the lattice only to extract something qualitative about the theory and then sort of prepare something that then can be divorced from the lattice. It's just true. Yeah, that's very important. You really want it to be true. So here is the one fact from lattice gauge theory. So this is, I said, I'll start from one observation. So what have I plotted here? I have plotted here the single eigenvalue density, rho, as a function of theta. Theta goes from 0 to 2 pi. And if you look carefully, there are two lines on this plot. One is orange, and the other is blue. The orange line is actually the eigenvalue density. And to be specific, it's a Wilson loop, square Wilson loop, And the size of that loop is about half a Fermi. How do I determine the size? I set the lambda n equal to the lambda QCD. So it's just a word when I say half a Fermi, but it gives you some feel. I used SU29, pure gauge theory, and this is done numerically. The blue line, which is almost indistinguishable on this plot, but believe me that if you zoom enough in, you will see that there are two lines, is the single eigenvalue density given by the heat kernel eigenvalue density. Everything will be defined later on. So this is a row which I put an HK for heat kernel up, and it is a it's a function of theta which depends on one single parameter, tau, I call it. And that parameter has been set to a numerical value very close to 4 for reasons that will become clear later on. But the point is that all the wiggles are represented by fitting this one single parameter. So now let me, although this may be tiresome, I want to define precisely every quantity that you have seen. So the Wilson loop matrix associated with the closed spacetime curve is given here. The index R, so script C denotes the curve itself, closed curve. X is a point on the curve. S is a new parameter, which is a smearing parameter that I will talk about soon. P is the path ordering, and R denotes the representation. So I'm taking the A mu, the power transporter, in an arbitrary representation R. So mentally you dot it into the matrices which are of the right dimension, and I'm doing this power transport. And classically, this is an element of SUN because I have not traced over at X. Now, what is S? S is a parameter which is strictly non-negative, and it has dimensions of length squared. And it is a smearing parameter, and that will be defined on the next transparency. But at the moment, you should think about it as another length squared introduced in the problem. And it is required, so this the language is not precise, but is required to make these objects finite SUN matrices with operator-valued entries, which they would not be otherwise. You would have singularities if you multiplied two such matrices in a quantum language just from the short-distance singularities. So I'll get back to it. What is the blue line? So the blue line is, this is both lines. So rho of n, I just defined a single eigenvalue density, what it means. You see, single eigenvalue density is not everything that doesn't contain all the information about the Wilson loop, but contains quite a lot. So you take all the eigenvalues of the Wilson loop, and you just count them, tick one. You make mentally a continuous histogram of it, and that defines rho of theta. Okay? And I'm working at theta CP equal to zero, so there is a symmetry from theta goes to 2 pi minus theta. So that's why the figure will look symmetrical under flip around the perpendicular to the point y. Now we get to smearing. Yeah, so what was what I mean here, smearing is required. Something is required. Smearing does it. That's what I meant. Okay, I'm not proving that smearing is the single way of making this thing happen, but it does it. This thing meaning that the fluctuating matrix representing the Wilson loop can be thought of at the quantum mechanical level as restricted to the space of SUN. Something which I always thought was essential for QCD, because it is this compactness that actually is responsible for the different behavior in the infrared that we see. Okay, so what is smearing? So that's a technical aside, but it's it's important. So the gauge fields that were on the previous slide actually live in five dimensions, where you have an r to the fourth times an r plus, and S lives on the r plus. And the usual quantum fields, which are four-dimensional, denoted by b mu, F denotes the fundamental, and the a mu, which was up there in the exponent, is defined for any S starting from zero by the simplest equation you could write, which is gauge invariant five-dimensionally, gauge covariant five-dimensionally, and has the symmetries of the problem that you want. You don't have any ambition to make that direction equivalent to the four directions, so you can use just the first power of F of the string, of the field strengths. And the quantum fields are on the boundary, and basically this is just a way of smoothing the quantum fluctuations. And from this equation, you recognize that S has to be of dimension 2. I mean, just naive dimension. This equation clear? Now, this is a direction which is clearly cries for being avoided, not wanting to be compactified. So clearly, the right gauge, the preferred gauge, is to make the S component of A zero. There's no obstruction to that. Then you don't lose any gauge invariant degrees of freedom. And then you get here just a derivative. So it's a first order equation in S. It's a sort of a flow. It's a gradient flow, because this is actually the gradient of a function that, as you know very well. Okay.
So you're saying A comma S,
yes,
is equal to D A. What is the equation for A?
So I imply that F is the usual expression of D mu A mu minus D mu A mu plus commutator in terms of A.
Yeah. Okay.
And B is produced by the field. So if you somebody mentioned Langevin quantization. So you think about Langevin quantization, you evolve, you have noise. I got to some point, I waited for long enough, and now the probability distribution on this plane in Langevin time no longer depends on how I started. It is at equilibrium. And now I decide to switch off the noise, which physically means I decide to put this five-dimensional Langevin system in contact with a zero-temperature heat bath. And I watch it, how it decays, how it smoothes out. But the amount of time that I watch it, time being Langevin time, which is of square dimension, is is of the same scale as anything else in the theory. OK, that's important. Okay.
I'm so sorry, but is this really F mu comma S equal?
Yeah, I'm abusing notation. I'm using S both for the coordinate and for the label of the coordinate. Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So this is just.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. So at S bigger than zero, all divergences that come from coinciding system space-time points in products of renormalized elementary fields are eliminated by a limitation on the resolution of the observer parameterized by S. So what do I mean? How to think about S? Think about S like you put some glasses that don't allow you to see too fine details of too fine fluctuations. Okay? And so renormalization, in the most traditional way, goes step one, you have a Lagrangian. Step two, you look at it. It has elementary fields. Step three, you decide you want to compute a prescription for correlation functions of the elementary fields at distinct space-time points. Then you analyze divergences. You find the counter terms if any are needed. If not, you just have to rescale if you have them all proper. And you have made the theory finite. Then you want to calculate something which is a composite operator, and you find new divergences, you call it operator product expansion. Okay? What I am doing is, I am eliminating everything that happens after that, and everything is now finite. You can take all these fields, the smear fields, and multiply them at the same point, and there will be no divergences. Okay, this is what this does. And the renormalization of the boundary field proceeds just as usual. You have no idea what I'm going to do with it afterwards. And technically, the definition of the smearing easily extends to any UV cutoff, because here is the gradient of the action. So if you know to regularize the theory, you will replace it by the appropriate gradient. So for those of you who know history of, you know, more mathematical things, in old times, this was gradient flow, was introduced by Bott. There were several very classic papers using gradient flow. Okay. Now, one thing that I thought was very important to me was to have a way of renormalizing these Wilson loops that I could say, tell somebody who is a string theorist what it is. Because at the end of the day, if I want to agree with a calculation done by a totally different method, I would like, the best situation is that that guy has something finite, I have something finite. We do not extract infinite pieces as we wish. We have done our job, but now we come to the table with precisely defined finite things. And that's what we have to match. So I don't know how to actually do that, because nobody knows what, you know, what the right formulation of this effective string theory is, except order by order, and that maybe. But I don't know how to do the smearing for that. So, but there is one tool that I have, which is the Makenko-Migdal equation, which has the ability to map all the quantum dynamics of the theory, to hide it at least formally, into a calculus in loop space. So the requirement that was to be able to write at the same formal level as the Makenko-Migdal derivation was done, this equation, and you see it is just heat kernel in loop space. Okay, so this Laplacian, for those of you, is the particular Laplacian that appears in the Makenko-Migdal equation, which is a sort of a second order differential operator, which is actually a derivation. So just to make it clear to you that it's not the most ordinary animal. And just to have some number in mind, the figure that I showed you, the amount of smearing, the width, if you wish, of those is about 0.1 Fermi. So this, since it is a square, I wrote here the square.
A question. Since the flow is proportional to the equation of motion, why is this non-trivial? I mean, why is it not trivial on shell? I mean, since the flow is proportional to the equation of motion.
No, the boundary conditions are totally fluctuating. So it remembers the S equals zero. It's totally, it's a functional, it's a first order differential equation in S. So it whatever it is at any finite S is defined by B mu. So if you wanted to calculate an expectation value of this A mu's, you would write it, if you wish, as a series in that B mu, and the B mu you would have to integrate with the ordinary measure. So I could have used something else here, which also had a smoothing thing. I just use the thing which has the least number of derivatives. For example, I would.
You're just wondering why that isn't zero.
Why isn't it zero in some sense? I mean, I believe I just want to. Is there a simple reason why it's not effectively zero? Because I mean, the
time right, goes
as,
the other way.
As an operator, the right side of that equation is zero. That's what's confusing me.
But this is going to be, I mean, in the stuck into other observables like a loop, right? So you've got other stuff.
So it's contact terms. So it's contact terms that make it non-trivial.
The boundary.
It's the boundary.
It's determined by the quantum field theory, which is fluctuating and technically off-shadow locationally, and then that derivative. Is
so Joe, let's just do the first step.
Yep.
Okay. The first step is that S equals zero. So you have to calculate a Wilson loop with the B mu's. That's the ordinary perturbation theory calculation. Then you start B mu. You say B mu equals B mu zero plus a correction S B mu one. You go through the that equation, this equation tells you how mu1 is expressed in terms of mu0. You calculate. I mean, there is now no way that that will be zero. You see, I'm not doing, what you have in mind is doing a path integral in which the fields depend on all the variables and you have a variation with respect to the same variables, but you don't do a path integral on the S piece of it.
Okay.
Okay? So now, what is this heat kernel density? So this is a standard formula. Okay, so this is just heat kernel. So what's heat kernel? You have the derivative with respect to time is equal to the diffusion. Diffusion is given by the Laplacian. This is the solution. The solution can be expressed as a probability density. So it has this probability density, which is a function, it's a class function. Okay, and for a technical reason, I replace the natural variable t here by the variable tau that you saw on the plot. The difference is the 1 over n effect, which messes a little bit up the numerics in terms of distinguishing 1 over n versus 1 over n squared, but it has there is some reason for doing it, which you will see. And if you're worried about a Laplacian on a curved manifold, I don't think that anybody is here, but if you are, then just think about a random motion on the group, which means you take a step, then you multiply by a randomly chosen Haar measure defined matrix, you make another step, and it's a multiplicative random sort of matrix model. Yannick knows a lot about those things. And the formula that I plotted in blue is this. And the way you derive this formula is basically this is also an invariant function, a class function, and you check which derivatives enter, which representations enter, and it turns you can get this formula, turns out, just from the Hooke Young-Thumb laws. So that's why p goes from 0 to n minus 1, because that's the number, maximum number this way, and q is the maximum number this way, and there is no flash in the diagram, in the Young diagram beyond it. And this is the Casimir, and this is the dimension. Okay, so when you look at this, you say what the message is, that the trace in a representation R is approximately given by this formula. This formula only tells you that the R dependence is Casimir. So that's Casimir dominance. But this is an interpretation because I've not tested all R's. I've tested only a very small subset of R's. This is a loose statement, but it helps you thinking. Now, you ask yourself, why is that true? Well, the R dependence is 2 to the g to the 4th in perturbation 3, at least. It could be g to the 6th, actually, but I'm not sure. For small loops. And for large loops, well, if the loops are smaller than 2 Fermi, then it is known that this formula for the string tension works very well. We also know that this cannot be true for very large loops, because there it should depend only on the analyte. This formula does not depend only on the analyte. However, in practice, in our definition of Fermi, this happens only for L's bigger than 2 Fermi, and my focus for the crossover will place it somewhere much below that. Then you ask, well, maybe this is exact. So you do a chi to goodness of fit estimates, and you say it's not true. These two curves are very close, but they're statistically different for sure. Well, for sure. As sure as anything is. Okay. So the objective I had now was, what do I do with this thing? I want something exact. I mean, I want an exact message from this. So you think about all these wiggles, and when you understand them, this is also old stuff. I should speed up. So there are two mechanisms which locate them. You have a repulsion of eigenvalues, So you see peaks. What does it, the peaks mean? The peaks mean that eigenvalues have preferred places they want to be, because they're more likely to be there, and then they have disliked places in between. These are the valleys. And this is a, there is a repulsion. The locations are sort of nailed down because the determinant has to be unit. So if you know n minus 1 of the eigenvalues, you know the last one. So you can't have it sort of rotationally jiggle back and forth. So that's why it's well defined. When you look at it, you see that the depths of the valley, and then you ask yourself, why this shape? And there is some attraction towards unity, and that's, in my view, the most essential part of QCD, is that parallel transport around a very tiny loop doesn't take you far. What does it mean? The precise statement is some matrix must in norm, parallel transport in norm must be close to one. And the swings between peak valleys are of order 1 over n. And what you see, so there are these two forces, if you wish. One force is forces as a function of the size of the loop. When the loop is very small, there is a force pushing the eigenvalues towards 1. When I make it bigger, the eigenvalues are, the force is smaller. And then there is a repulsion. So the forces balance, and that produces this shape, and that produces also the valley in the middle. Okay? So now when n goes to infinity, the peaks and valleys merge, you just get nice lines. I'm going slowly through this because it's not guaranteed that in any model that you can dream of in a field theory, the eigenvalues will really like to arrange themselves in a one-dimensional structure like that. That's not here. I don't prove it. I just show that it is true, and I explain in simple language why it happens. So here comes the main point. You see that when the loop is very small, you have a valley in that eigenvalue distribution around zero, which has no, you know, the rho of theta is strictly zero there. So a small loop will have this valley, which means probabilistically speaking, these Wilson loops, loop matrices, do not know that they are in a compact group. They don't explore SUN to the other pole. While for large loops, the valley disappears, and rho is non-zero on the entire axis, and the loop discovers that it is compact. And this is sort of the heart of the non-perturbative physics coming in, I think.
What is the role of S in this discussion? This is done at fixed S?
Oh, without, yeah, this is done at fixed S. I could lift the loop into R plus times R, but it's not necessary for this talk.
Do you reach this limit faster for some values of S?
You want to ask about S. Well, I'll talk more about S. Right now, think about S like something which is of the order of 0.1 Fermi. So a place for perturbation theory still should be good. And the size of the loop is sort of... And where this valley first opens up is the crossover.
And can the valley turn into a gap? Can it be... Can it open up?
Yes. Yes. So the valley, so it goes like that, and then it opens up into a real gap if you shrink the loop. The smaller the loop, the less likelihood is to find anything for finite.
And is it related to the Gross-Whitten transition?
No. It's related. I mean, anytime you have a unitary matrix, it is random, and
equal.
You squeeze it.
It's not equal.
No, it's a different universality class. You see, the Gross-Whitten transition is actually a lattice artifact, in the sense that if you do two-dimensional lattice gauge theory with the simplest action which your transition occurs, and if you look at physical size loops, okay, they will all be, if you don't do extra stuff, they will all be already have this compact support. So, and that's important as far as the right matrix model that would represent the transition. But morally, it is the same mechanism at this level, meaning you have a force that wants to do that and your eigenvalues want to repel. So the main point is the interpretation of this data is that at n equals infinity, a non-analyticity develops in rows, separating small from large loops. And this happens in two-dimensional now continuum theory. In two-dimensional, Casimir dominance is exact. So this is an exactly solvable problem. And this transition happens. It was discovered by Duhus and Tolleson many years ago. And the way they found their transition was nice. It was sort of the first time something was done with the McCain-Comigdal equation that was not obviously easier to do otherwise. And they derived the inviscid, so zero viscosity, Burger's equation. So this is the most elementary equation if you start teach a PDE or something course, you'll see it. And the eigenvalue distribution was essentially determined by this PDE. So I refer to it to the B-Hall transition.
But remember, yes? This two-dimensional transition is similar to the transition that occurs in the sphere.
Yes, it's similar, but I don't know whether it is exactly the same. I don't know whether it's exactly. There is a square of the dimensions there, and then here I don't have the square, so I don't know.
So in this case, certainly for the free energy, because there it appears to be free energy.
Yes, this is not for, well, there's, what do you mean, free energy here?
Sorry?
What would be the analog of free energy here? Oh no, it has nothing to do with the theory, sorry. So nothing to do with the free energy of the theory. This is an observable dependent, I change the loop shape, it will be somewhere else. I change the smearing to something slightly different, it will be somewhere else. The way I see it is that all the dynamics tells you there has to be something like that, and also only for loops which are not complicated. If a loop starts being very, very wiggly and complicated, then I don't know, in particular if it's self-intersecting, then you have multiple such things, it gets complicated. So this is in a big but restricted class of loops.
Certainly in this case, the phase transition was driven by objects.
By?
By defects or instantons, which, right, strictly speaking, have zero weight and infinite weight and zero action. I mean, there's a hard line between entropy and action, and n goes to infinity picks up.
Okay. So
presumably, that I think I would expect is a universal feature of all these large energy motions.
Right. So, just to be precise, so for clearly there is no transition at any finite end. So at finite end you have a shape. If I make n large enough so you can forget about the wiggles, there will be a valley there. And if you calculate rho around pi, that rho will be e to the minus n, some number. This is always how you get, so this is the general mechanism by which you get these non-analyticities, which are strictly a property of n equals infinity. But what I'm after is, I'm after is, given that, to understand how exactly, what kind of universal description, how many parameters do I have to describe the thing, even when n is finite, but big. Okay? So. So here are some pictures of what it looks like at infinite n. So these are small loops and the loops increase. Here is a phase transition point, and here it's bigger loops. And I don't know. Okay, here I have a plot of the support of the eigenvalues if you're not tired. So you see how it goes as t changes. And now you see why I picked t was close to 4 on the first transparency, because I showed you just the moment, or close to the moment, where the gap was opening. So this has a long story. Together with Narayanan, we conjectured 5 years ago that this was happening in 3 dimensions and in 4 dimensions. In 4 dimensions, we had some tests, it was supportive. In 4, it was too hard. I needed to actually upgrade my cluster in order to be able to do that. And my results will... I don't want to talk about that. Later, particularly since I'm recorded, there's no video recording. And later my talk will focus on results obtained on this upgraded hardware. So in any case, if any of you want to have your own little farm and do everything, I can tell you how to do it. I mean, from the level of screwdrivers. So Blaiseau and Nova conjecture that this large N universality, so now the question is how, you know, you want to go beyond N equals infinity. So what is the description? They guess that it should be the full, meaning reintroducing the second derivative term in the Burgers equation. And this proved to be correct, you'll see. So what I'm taking out as exact is that the reason these fits work so well, or work so well, I cannot explain. The reason they work is that SUN, gauge theory, continuum gauge theory, has this property that it has this transition in this eigenvalue density if you define it in some reasonable way. And this is the exact message that I want to take out. Okay, so now I will show you how we made the case that this is really true. Okay, you never can make a case more than beyond reasonable doubt with numerical methods, and it's not a good thing to put in a paper, as I realized, because there is always somebody that will doubt it and thinks that he's reasonable, and if that person happens to be a referee, then you will have to replace it by something less strong, which in my case was a convincing argument that this is a fact, which to me sounded stronger. But that's why I'm not a lawyer. So what is tau? Tau is the overall scale of the loop C. So for square loop of side L, it is just L. So the picture is the following. A loop is a big object. I split the parameters into a shape and a location, if you wish, an orientation, and a scale. And I'm now, the location and rotation doesn't matter, I'm averaging over it, and I'm varying the scale at fixed shape. So we need a new observable in order to zoom in. So this is technique. Do you want to zoom in now at the eigenvalue where the action happens? So by the way, -1 eigenvalues are actually things that you get from an instanton, as you know very well. So an instanton in, so for, I don't know, if there is any, young people, let's say, you always accuse the young people. So you have this R4, and you calculate the parallel transport of a line, straight line, you get -1 for the parallel, which you just stick in the instanton solution. This is a conformal theory. You put it in a circle, it will stay close to -1. That means that instantons which are small enough to fit on the line, will give you some contribution. That's a -1 e to the -n contribution, because this happens for small enough loops. I have not worked out precisely whether there is a point in which I can actually use the instanton as a calculation, and there is nothing else which is non-perturbative and and takes over it, and then the instantons are useless. So I don't know. But anyhow, it's...
If it was an instant, then you have a mechanism.
Yeah, it would be nice if it were. So, but what it requires, I have to understand precisely the e to the minus n. Actually, that's, I'm not sure. This is quite nasty, this model. To actually do calculations, it's messy. So I'm picking the best variables I can define so that it doesn't look messy. So we pick this variable. So you want to emphasize something from minus 1. So you look at all the eigenvalues. And when I first think about y, set y to 0. So then when Wf has a minus 1 eigenvalue, you want something that knows about it. The determinant will really, so the log of the determinant will have a transition when the gap closes. So, and this is also the generating functional of all the asymmetric representations, so all the, you know, this young tableaus. And y is just sort of the variable of the generating function, and it, and this is the function that the log of it will have an analyticity. So now I say, okay, for finite n, no problems. I define an expansion in y around y equals 0. That's because of CP invariance you have. And I define one observable of the loop, which is given by that. Lattice people will recognize that it looks like a Binder cumulant, and actually is. And I don't want to explain more why it is, because that's a technical thing. Okay. So this. So if you now take just the heat kernel case, you calculate the observable, you calculate this logarithmic derivative of it, and you can very easily prove it. Basically comes because of the fact that this is sort of a discrete Gaussian, that it obeys exactly this equation. So 2n is the viscosity in the 1 over 2n is the viscosity in the Bugge's equation, and you may, but I leave it later to you. Well, I think about why it matters, if at all, that this is 1 over an even number. I mean, Bugge's equation cannot care about that, but here it comes out like that. So the initial condition is just this. This is a funny way of saying that it is, you know, all the eigenvalues unit matrix. And this produces, so the equation separates the force pushing the eigenvalues. It comes in only from the initial condition, from the PDE itself, which expresses only the repulsion. And if you have some experience with this matrix models, it's very nice because, there is a classification of equations, and there's a question of moving singularities. So the question is, there are some equations, equations will give you singularities which either depend on the initial conditions or part of the structure itself. This is the type that it is motivated by the initial condition. Okay. So what does the Bugge's equation you can very easily analyze? I mean, it is just wave propagation where you have a nonlinear equation for the amplitude. The amplitude is related to velocity in a nonlinear way. So it's clear that when you make a wave like that, and it moves here, it moves faster than here, you will get that. If you do it that way, you will get nothing. OK? So here I show you what happens to the at n equals infinity, how you go through the value tau equals 4, which is, this is the critical tau equals 4. And at finite n, there is no jump. The viscous term in the Bugge's equation limits the steepness at y equals 0. And so since you have something that is going to jump, so it will have an infinite slope, so it would be silly to look at the slope itself. You look at the inverse slope, which is nice. So you take the inverse slope at y equals 0. You see how it evolves. And when you stick it into the Bugge's equation, you get this observable again. Okay. So it is designed to capture this n equals infinity thing. And here I show you, well, what happens when I start with a negative slope. it increases until zero. And then it stops increasing. Okay, the omega jumps to a value which makes the right-hand side stays put at infinity or at the inverse slope at zero. And if you want to look at a plot, because you are counting the money in your pocket and you want to know what it would take to simulate it, you see that to actually see it, to see it build up, you would have to go to n, like 500, and multiplying two matrices, I wasn't sure, but it turns out there are some people who still don't know, doing refereeing. So it is n to the third operations, so that's prohibitive. So now, what am I predicting? Okay, so I am predicting that you take an arbitrary, nice, regular loop in Young-Mills, you smear it, as I said, and then you can compute this observable, you can compute these three coefficients, A0, A1, A2, and I tell you that if you multiply this by this, you take the limit, you get this number, and this number, and this number, and this number. Okay? And the proof is in the heat kernel case, but I think it's true. It's a nice application of the Young, Li-Yang theorem, that all the zeros of this are actually on the imaginary axis. Why imaginary? Okay. So here are some details about the simulation, which I would prefer to go fast through, given the time. So we did many values of n, many volumes, and just so you understand how it's working, I have 40 machines. Each machine has an Intel 7. The CPU has 4 cores, which means, so this is done in dumb parallelism. These machines are not, I didn't spend money on anything fancy to make them talk fast to each other. So I get 160 gauge configurations that I can generate. Now, before the floods in Thailand, it was very cheap to buy hard disks. So I have 2 terabyte hard disks in addition to the ordinary sync on each machine, which means that I basically made myself a database of gauge configurations for as many couplings that I want. I make so many couplings that I do not have to extrapolate. I just can do ordinary spline interpolation, give you a continuous function as a function of the lattice coupling for anything you want. I don't have to worry about where to do the simulation or anything like that. And I can reuse this same gauge fields for different observables. So when you see the ranges, this B, you should see G squared N is the tooth coupling that was mentioned. So, but all the kinds of 4 pi's have been set aside. So don't, if you want to feel, just 0.38 is sort of a weak coupling already on the lattice, at the lattice spacing. And point so is a ridiculously strong coupling. Just. Now there is for people who understand know the details, there is an issue of finite volume effects. It's delicate, having to do with reduction. I'll skip it because we decided to use, since I wanted to be sure that this is true, I didn't want to use reduction, I didn't want to use any simplifying assumption. I wanted to do the most brutal, simple, direct sync to be sure that this is not an artifact. So for each configuration, I extract A0, A1, A2. From this, I compute omega n. I have them for a function of the lattice size and the coupling constant. And this is what data looks like. Okay? So these actually are spaced, so there are some error bars. Don't get too impressed. This is a relatively large range, so the error bars are. But still, I'm not going down to zero, so I'm relatively honest. And this is what the data looks like. And these are just, this is not even spline. I think this is just plotting it by connect. But you can, in the code, we do spline interpolation. Okay, so now we have a technical problem. How to deal with the slow convergence? I cannot do this large ends. And the idea is very simple. Let me assume that I know that it is really omega n. And therefore, I will map from what I will use omega n as a map in control theory. It's an S function, whatever. And I define, therefore, a variable tau n of BL by solving this equation. So this function is known, this function is measured, and this finds, and this is done at one point, and this being monotonic functions has one solution. So this being a monotonic function, there is one solution, this defines these tau n's. And the idea is that if I prove that this tau n of B of L goes to its large n limit, just like Mike was finding string tensions and everything was behaving nicely, very rapidly converging, if this tau does the same thing, then I know that when I have to compute this guy, which is what I need in order to show the transition, okay, I actually can replace the argument inside by tau infinity. And this one, I know, this is analytic already. This I know that it has the right limit. Okay, so that's what's being done. So here you see raw data, and here you see it remapped into tau. And by I, you see that the convergence is a function of n. So here are the 3n plotted in different colors. You see that the convergence is better. And you see a rapid convergence relatively already for n equals 29, which you did not see, you wouldn't see here. Okay. So now that you know that it happens, nobody cares. Well, most people. There are people who do not care about the lattice. And they want to know whether they have something to say about the continuum limit. And basically what I do here is I use a well-tried technique that gives you a formula for what would be the physical, the lattice spacing in physical units. And it involves the formula that somebody went to Stockholm for here. And it involves a sort of a improvement here, which is a, it's a little bit of witchcraft. I'll talk about it later. Okay. And then what you expect is that this should go to the continuum limit as a squared, okay? Parity reasons prohibit something like a. So here is a squared is like 1 over l squared. And you see the extrapolation is quite sizable. The fact that it works so well, at least for this point, but it works well in general, probably this is one of the better points, but tells you that there is a main source to the one of this a squared effect, because usually different things would contribute. It shouldn't go like that so nice, but it does. So probably if I were smarter, I would have found that. And clearly the suspicion is this gimmick here. This gimmick here is not supposed to be infinitely accurate. So, and now, so the way to think about it is from the lattice, now I take lattice data, but I plot them in a funny way. I plot the tau, which is the lattice quantity defined, and I plot this, which is also defined in lattice units, a precise number. And I plot what I have done. And now I have to sit at a fixed point here and extrapolate downwards. Sometimes I have more points, sometimes I have less points. There are all kinds of limitations. And this is the continuum thing that I got. It's wiggly, but there are error bars on it, so the wiggles are not statistically significant. They simply reflect that I had different number of data points, a different thing. But you, since some of you don't do numerical work, I wanted to see that it's really very simple what you're doing. I mean, so this is tau 19, so tau 19 is a, the important point is that this function is smooth. That's all. It's smooth through the point 4, which is the point of the transition. So here is the main argument. that this is a property of the continuum.
You could continue, back, you don't have to continue to extrapolate horizontally, right? You could go sideways.
I don't want to go sideways.
But that also defines a continuum, really, no?
No.
You have to go like
I don't know. I'm a simple man. I want to go this way.
In that case, maybe you would have more points.
Yeah, no, I'm happy that when I do it this way, it's good enough for me. Okay? Maybe there is some trick there. I'm not sure. I have to think. That's very difficult. Thinking. So now I look at this continuum tau, and you know, tau appears upstairs, and if you know that there is a 1 over log, typically, so you will plot 1 over tau as a function of log. And these are the different lines. You see some trend, but you can't tell. I mean, this is too well converged for you to tell how fast it converges as a function of m. So it's a weak dependence. Okay. And the fact that the lines are straight is consistent with asymptotic freedom. There is more to say about that. But I don't have time. So then you ask yourself, can you do something else? Because when you do this trick of you sort of part of the list that I gave you of numbers that I would check becomes tautological. Okay, now you have to take my word that one ratio is not. So this is one ratio that so this tests that indeed there is an exponent 3/4. There, 3/2, and that's the way it is different from those written. Okay. So the other ratio is automatic. Another thing which is nice, actually, which has to do with the local density, and you basically look at the distance, delta theta, between the two eigenvalues which are closest to the pi. And that thing has to go like 3/4, and it works fantastically well, probably too well to work all the time. Sometimes, if you do enough simulations in your lifetime, some of them will come out better than they should. Just keep at it. So, there are forms of transparencies afterwards, which I will go faster. Okay, so we confirmed that there is a large and phase transition for smeared Wilson loops in the Euclidean four-dimensional continuum as you engage theory at critical loop size. That we confirmed that the transition has universal properties with universality class defined in terms of the heat kernel, and these are the critical exponents. What does it mean? Well, a gap in the Wilson loop just I'm throwing out one thing. If you did it in the Hamiltonian language, and you thought about the single reasonable mechanism of confinement that I know, which is in terms of two disorder parameters, disorder operators, then it's inconsistent to have a disorder operator that succeeds to thread a loop if it has a gap in the eigenvalue, because that thing would shift all the eigenvalues one way or another. It would rotate the entire eigenvalue distribution. So in a way, you can phrase it that at least for the smeared loops, the tooth disorder loop operator cannot be arbitrarily thin. I'm not thin. It has to have a finite thickness. I'm not saying that it exists. But if it existed, what is the most interesting question is that once you have an elliptic, the main question is, does it, okay, Wilson loop smeared, maybe my private hobby, okay? Is it something that really has a general physical meaning? So you should see whether or not it has some impact on the S matrix of the theory. So first of all, what am I talking about? I'm talking about specifically the connected S matrix. So S can be replaced in terms of S sub C using clustering. Now, this S sub C, how do I define it? I define this S sub C mentally by calculating each entry of it, so until I get something non-zero. I'm not setting something to zero. I go to the leading order in okay, I'm just saying things which are probably very trivial to many of you, but experience has taught me that they save some time and then. So now I don't know. The question is, does it feed into this matrix or not? If it does not, if it does, clearly it's a big deal, because it would mean that in some sense, for long distances, some of the old 60s stuff, maybe even right, you would have, you know, maximal analyticity, exactly linear Rege trajectories, but this would stop being true at some scale. And there, something else would happen, which joins smoothly.
You've lost
the real question is whether is whether this feeds into correlation, Euclidean correlation functions at some point.
At what order in n?
N equals n.
No, sorry. At what order in the number of traces that you get? You see, that's...
Well, as you say, the leading order.
Right, but you're going to any order you want. I mean, I can look at trace of u to the k, where k is of order n. Okay. I don't think so. But I think...
I
don't think that there is a monolithicity for if you look only at observable, where the representations that enter have a number of boxes, which is finite as n goes to infinity. Because I know that the traces of ordinary Wilson loops do not reflect it. And when I look at what the mechanism for the singularity is, it is buried in the Fourier coefficients of these chi's, not the chi's themselves. Okay? However, if I take a point of view, so the point of view that I was struggling with and I still am, is I'm going back in time and thinking about the so-called program of dual topological unitarization, which was sort of defined before the people had any field theory. And then after Veneziano came up with some formula, Veneziano wrote a paper a paper which I interpret as saying that if you compute the connected S matrix in this manner, that would be the first step in the program of dual topological. So to do the program of dual topological unitarization, you need a first step. The first step has to give you an SC defined for any number of particles.
So,
right. But that was something guessed. Now the logic is the following. I'm saying, okay, you're Superman, or you have a huge computer, you can answer any question about the larger limit about QCD. Okay? Can you actually now define the first step in the dual topo? Is it true? Is it really true that you will have this corresponding meaning if you do this prescription for computing all SC entries at leading order in 1 over n? That set of numbers, that infinite S matrix, will obey the kind of unitarity analyticity maximal that was there in the Veneziano model 26 dimensions.
Clear? I don't
it's not, I mean, that one you just write down. This one forces on you some numbers, right? I mean, this is, you say it has to be. Okay, but it's not. No, I don't know, I mean, whether it has to be or not has to be. I just want to make sure that logically there is no proof. There is no proof that at infinite n, if I collected these numbers, these things would be described by a ordinary Veneziano amplitude. You agree?
Well, I wouldn't be described by...
I do Euclidean, I analytically continue, I do everything.
Yeah, but then you're just describing the large end limit of pure angles.
Yeah, so they're globals, they can scatter. They have a non-trivial S matrix.
They're all stable? Or
yeah.
So what is the issue? They're all perturbatively infinite.
The issue is whether when I scatter any number of them, is it true that I can write a diagram with L naughts and the whole prescription which gives me a scattering amplitude?
You're worried about whether there will be non-perturbative corrections.
Whether will be, most I'm worried whether there are not moving pole.
The argument is, of course, that based on it's only proven to any order of perturbation.
Yeah.
If you accept arguments based on things that you would chart any order of perturbation,
right,
then you can sort of give a proof.
Okay, there is a question which is not clear to me, which has to do with non-moving poles, whether you have to add extra vertices. But let's leave that to the end.
How is this connected to
non-monotonicity? So the point that I'm really... there was an assumption of maximal analyticity, which meant, as far as I understand it, that every...
Maximal analyticity in momentum space.
Right. So it was maximal analyticity in terms of the Mandelstam variables. Okay, so you are on shell, so I didn't want to say momentum space in that respect. Okay. That said, that any singularity that happens, you have a physical reason for it. If it is kinematical, then by changing variables, you can get rid of it. And otherwise, it is just that you have crossed some threshold. And that assumption of maximal analyticity, I am questioning it. Why? The first argument, there was an old argument, you know about that very well. So there was an argument, Mandelstam had this argument that if you look at alpha of S, you write a dispersion relation, that thing proves to you that the radial trajectories have to be strictly, alpha of T, sorry, the radial trajectories have to be strictly linear. And I was always shocked by this statement. Strictly, I mean, it meant that at large end, something really... I don't know why it happens. Always in Santa Barbara, I come with the lousiest laptop possible.
We only like Macintoshes.
Yeah, I realized it. You can't even walk on the street and see some poor guy in a cafe who doesn't have an Apple. So that I sit down and put down there this machine to show New Jersey has arrived.
So, Herbert, can I jump in with some very basic confusion?
Yes.
So,
I mean, the yes was you can jump in.
There's non-analyticity when I look at a single eigenvalue distribution as a function of the size of a loop. To see that, I have to be studying that loop with a resolution to detect individual eigenvalues, or if you will, I have to be looking at... I mean, what I'm trying to say is if I simply look at the expectation value of a single loop in the fundamental representation.
No, absolutely. I said that any loop in any, if you have a Young tableau with k boxes and the k is finite, n goes to infinity, there will be no...
Exactly. So
right.
Now
but
we're
not,
talking about S matrices.
Yes.
Right? To the best of my knowledge, if I want to study blue ball scattering in this theory, it is sufficient to use as interpolating fields traces of Wilson loops in the fundamental representation.
Not only traces for uncomplicated loops.
We're in more than two dimensions, so I mean they don't have to be self-intersecting. They can be nice.
I don't know what happens for a very funny shaped loop. I'm not sure that the thing happens, even for a very funny system.
I surely don't know any argument that says I have to have loops which wind around an order n, a number of times which grows as n grows.
I have a simple math. So you take...
Those are all observables.
I mean, the reason... Okay.
Right, precisely. Sorry.
If n is finite, okay, there is a finite number of particles in the theory. When n is infinite, we have an infinite number of global states. An infinite number, now, is that infinite of the order of n, or is that infinite strictly? First n goes to infinity, then k goes to infinity. When I see something can happen, when k becomes of order n, I go with both of them to infinity, then I think that if I... So the question is, if I scatter all the n blue balls, and I take the connected S matrix from it, I already multiplied fundamental representations an order n time. Then I would be sensitive.
Yeah, you're a masochist.
Let's go back to the...
You're not saying that the number of blue balls of a given mass is going to increase?
Not a given mass, but the number of blue balls in general.
But you're refusing to fix the number of blue balls that you're interested in studying scattering of.
No, you see, there are two things. I'm going to leading order in 1 over n.
Yes.
Okay. At leading order in 1 over n, yes, I want to look at arbitrary number of blue balls, including order n.
That's nasty.
Well, that's a complicated sum of scattered algebras. That's how you want to see it in this matrix.
The way I think about it, I think about S as a matrix, and
scattered
S sub C. Yeah, and I have on the diagonal ones, and then I make the diagonals which are parallel to it multi-particle scatterings, and they are down by the powers of 1 over n, which go with the number of particles. But I want the full matrix, because when I do S dagger S, I want to be able, it's like I can't talk about an A dagger in a harmonic oscillator without thinking about the full matrix. I cannot truncate that thing to a finite matrix. So that's how I'm thinking. So look, I did not want, nobody wants a non-elasticity, but if you want to ask a sharp question, the sharp question that bothers me is it true or not that the blue balls, or if I put in fermions, the same story goes, that the radial trajectories are strictly linear in infinite MQCD? This is no longer anything esoteric. Strictly linear. I'm not speaking a fraction of a percent. Now, this is not compatible with asymptotic freedom. I mean, yes. People can have calculated this radial trajectories from some scatterings, taking them to some kinematic regime where you can do the scattering. You won't get something straight there. I mean, they use some diagrams. So. You get, but this is not, so then if it's that, then it's not the other one. If it does that, then I don't believe it is linear anywhere except asymptotically. Never exactly linear. On the other hand, if there were a non-elasticity, it could be exactly linear. It could go like that. At some point, poof, there is this transition and goes straight linear. Now, this doesn't make much sense because that means I have to tell you where it does it. So I don't know. I'm just sharing my confusion here. But the basic, and I think the answer is that the maximum analyticity assumption that gave Veneziano things like that is incorrect. For if you start with input, if you make this imaginary thing that you start with input coming from QCD. So there's a general
statement. What is the connection between analyticity and Mandelstam variables and analyticity of your eigenvalue distribution?
Well, no,
I just see those as totally distinct.
No, it's as a function of the size of the loop.
The real, I mean, it's a scale. I think the issue is...
It's a scale, no, it's the same. It's a
scale. You don't expect infinity Green's function, even to have because that would reflect some singularity.
Okay, maybe I can go on.
He's asking, does this show up anywhere?
Yeah, but maybe I'll finish. I wanted to show you a few more things, and then we can go back. Is that okay? Huh? Yes.
I guess we also.
Oh.
I don't know.
What's
coffee?
Oh, 3:15 is coffee. Okay, so.
We don't really want to continue till 5.
Whatever you want, guys. I mean, I don't care. I can tell you what I have. Okay, I'll show you. It's for. So this is something explaining about smearing. Anybody wants, I can go more in detail. It has smearing looks like a nice technique. I don't understand how smearing interplays so well with the OPE. It's a very nice thing. Dependence on smearing parameter may give you the anomalous dimensions. There are lots of things to say about it. There is this nice expansions that you have for small and big loops. And if you notice, then what's missing L squared, which is the per excellence, signal of confinement, and also there is this SVZ, the sum rules, which we have been living for so many years with, which work nicely, and now you can define what they are, and for smeared operators you can. So there might be something which has nothing to do with the question of analyticity, which comes out from here. Also, the issue that you played with, which had to do with the inversion symmetry as a way of getting the n equal, simple way of getting the n equals 4 Wilson loop expectation value. Smearing violates that. In a conformal field theory, smearing is very nice, but it really distinguishes very much the infinity from anybody else, so it breaks it up. So. Maybe that could be done, though that's technical. Now, another issue, so I'm obviously focusing on this question of smearing, because I believe that anything that comes from an effective string theory, which is universal, should not depend on the smearing, because basically, what is an effective string theory? It's something that describes very large loops, so that they shouldn't care whether I look at them very carefully or not. And so here I show you some data, preliminary data, which shows you. So here you see this smearing dependence. So this is a smearing parameter, the smearing dependence of the string tension that I extract, and it stops to be smearing dependent, which I was hoping it would do, and. Here I show you some determination of the string tension because I want to get rid of this LC, which had this tadpole improvement formula, and replace it by another observable. And this is, I think, it. So this is shows you the end dependence, and so we are determining the scale now, but the end dependence is, our accuracy is such that we cannot see much end dependence starting from n of the order of 10^20. Okay, now I'm done.
Maybe the best thing is if there are any sort of brief questions, maybe we can ask now, and if there are longer questions or discussions, maybe we can let other people lead.
You're not yes. Smearing fits into cases, supersymmetric cases where.
Okay, so it's a little bit tricky because a person is like, okay, so how would you smear a fermion? First question. So it sounds silly to put a del slash on the right-hand side because that would not be whatever good equation it is. I mean, it won't be a positive definite thing. So you would like to smear it with a square. Or that's not supersymmetric unless you do. So you have to be more careful how you supersymmetrize. Pardon me?
No,
didn't work it out. There is another question. So basically, if you look at detail at an effective string computation, Okay, there are always non-universal terms. So there are many formulations. So let's look at the most naive formulation in which you just have a disk and you parameterize it by just perpendicular directions and you write an action for the sink, the surface that leads on that sink, and you add those fluctuations. And slowly we are learning that if you expand in powers of 1 over square root of sigma a in fixed shape, there are lots of terms in that expansion which actually are universal. The symmetries of the hidden and explicit symmetries of the theory are quite powerful. They give you many powers. However, there is always a freedom to put boundary, terms that live only in the boundary, which are not universal. And they are the terms which correspond to corner and perimeter divergences in the field theory language, and they will have an S dependence. And you probably remember it well, that you cannot put a perimeter term in the Markenko-Migdal. It's not what was used to be called the Stokes functional. If you look at that thing and you ask how would you regulate it, they actually found a regularization. It's exactly this Smearing regularization, because it's so natural. You just put a Gaussian and you put a Wirtz. And then you do make it a Stokes function. So it's clear that to me, that, and also it's true from the data, that when you take even a large loop and you start fitting it, there will be the terms which are a smear loop. So will be the terms which are universal, which I believe are all the terms which come from the number sort of an action up to some power. But there will be this, some leading terms, I mean leading in some two other terms which have to do with corners and kinks and perimeter. And this will be smearing dependent. Now, why smearing is needed, the easiest way I find to think about it, please feel free to leave, is so the Coulomb potential, the signs are such that the expectation level of a Wilson loop is e to the plus g times t over r. That thing is bigger than 1, so it cannot come from a unitary matrix. Okay? So what happens in reality? You have a minus, a big minus thing. So clearly, you have to do something about it if you want to insist on still having unitary matrices as fluctuating coupled. Now, if you don't want to, then the whole thing is gone. I mean, this whole transition is there. So that's why I'm not sure that this transition really has any strong. It could very well have no physical consequence whatsoever, as far as I know. So another question you can ask is what happens in.
It looks like you're going into a fifth dimension, which is how you really regularize strange calculations and.
Yeah, the difference is that there you are going with a second order differential equation, and I'm going with a first order differential equation. And there's another difference, and I'm really not an expert, but I know how it's done in N equals 4, when you actually are only care about the conformal class of metrics on the boundary. So there is so you use that too when you continue, when you do this, the equation, this Pfefferman-Granum coordinates or whatever. So neither of these ingredients exists here, nor is there any G-union.
What happens if you use Polyakov line instead of
Wilson? Polyakov lines have a first order transition which is bulk, and I am therefore it's not the one that I want. I mean, that's well understood and washes out anything like that. This is a much more delicate thing. All I can say is this, why if you just go back to very basics and you think why is there confinement, it has to do with the fact that going to parallel transport around the loop, it's in a compact place. And if the eigenvalues have a gap, this thing does not know that it is in a compact. There's no way around that. how significant, how clever the theory is to manage to fool me, I don't know. But, and also there was an issue, I mean, I think this problem of, I think in the, is Mike, you, David, somebody else. I mean, that in the audience, people who have quarreled with themselves, basically, with, about this, whether it's analytic or not. Because you always feel that when you have a theory whose two variables morally are on a compact thing, but you are working perturbations under the algebra, that's where non-perturbative effect have to happen when you realize that it's not, you know, x, y, whatever model you want to take, you know, hundreds of examples. That's always the same thing. It's the source of disorder.
But still on smearing for renormalizing loops. For self-intersecting loops, you know that renormalization has to involve mixing with rearrange loops where you reconnect at the self-intersection, and it sort of morally seems like there has to be some nice generalization.
Yeah, I don't know.
For self-intersecting loops, have you thought about that at all?
I don't know the answer. Okay, so what I know? Let me just make a few statements. The derivation of the equation, the fusion equation, does not actually make an assumption. All I'm using is the rule that. You know, the keyboard, either d mu, delta, either you are rational, well, either migdal way or the delta squared delta x mu squared. That thing gets replaced by the equation, by delta. That derivation, that it's just a linear equation, is formally correct. But, you know, all these things are correct only as little diagrams. I mean, they're not. But it's true that all, so it could be that all the effects that you're talking about intersecting loops are there from the boundary theory. But your point is, I don't know the answer. It's a valid point. I thought about it, not enough, but definitely not enough to give you an answer. Don't know. But it's the right point to ask, yes. It's absolutely the right point, if you want to go to this, on this line.
Questions now, let's think of.
Okay.